Page 169, part 3. Page 170 is blank. Page 171, chapter 20. 7 years was a long time to be away from one's clan. A man's place was not always there, waiting for him. As soon as he left, someone else rose and filled it. The clan was like a lizard. If it lost its tail, it soon grew another. Okonkwo knew these things. He knew that he had lost his place among the 9 masked spirits who administered justice in the clan. He had lost the chance to lead his warlike clan against the new religion, which, he was told, had gained ground. He had lost the years in which he might have taken the highest titles in the clan. But some of these losses were not irreparable. He was determined that his return should be marked by his people. He would return with a flourish and regain the 7 wasted years. Even in his first year in exile, he had begun to plan for his return. The first thing he would do would be to rebuild his compound on a more magnificent scale. He would build a bigger barn than he had had before, and he would build huts for 2 new wives. Then he would show his wealth by initiating his sons into the Osor society. Only the great men in the clan were able to do this. Page 172. Okonkwo saw clearly the high esteem in which he would be held, and he saw himself taking the highest title in the land. As the years of exile passed one by one, it seemed to him that his chi might now be making amends for the past disaster. His yams grew abundantly, not only in his motherland, but also in Umuofia, where his friend gave them out year by year to sharecroppers. Then the tragedy of his first son had occurred. At first it appeared as if it might prove too great for his spirit. But it was a resilient spirit, and in the end, Okonkwo overcame his sorrow. He had 5 other sons, and he would bring them up in the way of the clan. He sent for the 5 sons, and they came and sat in his obi. The youngest of them was 4 years old. You have all seen the great abomination of your brother. Now he is no longer my son or your brother. I will only have a son who is a man, who will hold his head up among my people. If any of you prefers to be a woman, let him follow Wu Ye now while I am alive, so that I can curse him. If you turn against me when I am dead, I will visit you and break your neck. Okonkwo was very lucky in his daughters. He never stopped regretting that Isin Ma was a girl. Of all his children, she alone understood his every mood. A bond of sympathy had grown between them as the years had passed. Isin Ma grew up in her father's exile and became one of the most beautiful girls in Banta. She was called Crystal of Beauty, as her mother had been called in her youth. Page 173. The young, ailing girl who had caused her mother so much heartache had been transformed, almost overnight, into a healthy, buoyant maiden. She had, it was true, her moments of depression, when she would snap at everybody like an angry dog. These moods descended on her suddenly and for no apparent reason. But they were very rare and short-lived. As long as they lasted, she could bear no other person but her father. Many young men and prosperous middle-aged men of Banta came to marry her. But she refused them all because her father had called her one evening and said to her, "There are many good and prosperous people here, but I shall be happy if you marry in Umuofia when we return home." That was all he had said. But Isin Ma had seen clearly all the thought and hidden meaning behind the few words, and she had agreed. "Your half-sister, Obiageli, will not understand me," Okonkwo said, "but you can explain to her." Although they were almost the same age, Isin Ma wielded a strong influence over her half-sister. She explained to her why they should not marry yet, and she agreed also. And so the 2 of them refused every offer of marriage in Banta. "I wish she were a boy," Okonkwo thought within himself. She understood things so perfectly. Who else among his children could have read his thoughts so well? With two beautiful grown-up daughters, his return to Umuofia would attract considerable attention. His future sons-in-law would be men of authority in the clan. The poor and unknown would not dare to come forth. Page 174. Umuofia had indeed changed during the 7 years Okonkwo had been in exile. The church had come and led many astray. Not only the low-born and the outcast, but sometimes a worthy man had joined it. Such a man was Ogbuefi Ogonaw, who had taken two titles and who, like a madman, had cut the anklet of his titles and cast it away to join the Christians. The white missionary was very proud of him, and he was one of the first men in Umuofia to receive the sacrament of Holy Communion, or Holy Feast, as it was called in Igbo. Ogbuefi Ogonaw had thought of the feast in terms of eating and drinking, only more holy than the village variety. He had therefore put his drinking horn into his goatskin bag for the occasion. But, apart from the church, the white men had also brought a government. They had built a court where the district commissioner judged cases in ignorance. He had court messengers who brought men to him for trial. Many of these messengers came from Umuru on the bank of the great river, where the white men first came many years before, and where they had built the center of their religion and trade and government. These court messengers were greatly hated in Umuofia because they were foreigners and also arrogant and high-handed. They were called Kotmar, and because of their ash-colored shorts, they earned the additional name of Ashibatoks. They guarded the prison, which was full of men who had offended against the white man's law. Some of these prisoners had thrown away their twins, and some had molested the Christians. Page 175. They were beaten in the prison by the Kotmar and made to work every morning clearing the government compound and fetching wood for the white commissioner and the court messengers. Some of these prisoners were men of title, who should be above such mean occupation. They were grieved by the indignity and mourned for their neglected farms. As they cut grass in the morning, the younger men sang in time with the strokes of their machetes, "Kotma of the ash buttocks, he is fit to be a slave. The white man has no sense. He is fit to be a slave." The court messengers did not like to be called ashy buttocks, and they beat the men. But the song spread in Umuofia. Okonkwo's head was bowed in sadness as Obierika told him these things. "Perhaps I have been away too long," Okonkwo said, almost to himself. "But I cannot understand these things you tell me. What is it that has happened to our people? Why have they lost the power to fight?" "Have you not heard how the white man wiped out Abame?" asked Obierika. "I have heard," said Okonkwo, "but I have also heard that Abame people were weak and foolish. Why did they not fight back? Had they no guns and machetes? We would be cowards to compare ourselves with the men of Abame. Their fathers had never dared to stand before our ancestors." Page 176. "We must fight these men and drive them from the land." "It is already too late," said Obierika sadly. "Our own men and our sons have joined the ranks of the stranger. They have joined his religion, and they helped uphold his government. If we should try to drive out the white men in Umuofia, we should find it easy. There are only two of them. But what of our own people, who are following their way and have been given power? They would go to Umuru and bring the soldiers, and we would be like Abame." He paused for a long time and then said, "I told you on my last visit to Banta how they hanged Aneto." "What has happened to that piece of land in dispute?" asked Okonkwo. "The white man's court has decided that it should belong to Naama's family, who had given much money to the white man's messengers and interpreter." "Does the white man understand our custom about land?" "How can he, when he does not even speak our tongue? But he says that our customs are bad, and our own brothers, who have taken up his religion, also say that our customs are bad. How do you think we can fight when our own brothers have turned against us? The white man is very clever. He came quietly and peaceably with his religion. We were amused at his foolishness and allowed him to stay. Now he has won our brothers, and our clan can no longer act like one. He has put a knife on the things that held us together, and we have fallen apart. Page 177. How did they get hold of Aneto to hang him? Asked Okonkwo. When he killed Oduche in the fight over the land, he fled to Aninta to escape the wrath of the earth. This was about 8 days after the fight, because Oduche had not died immediately from his wounds. It was on the 7th day that he died. But everybody knew that he was going to die, and Aneto got his belongings together in readiness to flee. But the Christians had told the white man about the accident, and he sent his Kotma to catch Aneto. He was imprisoned with all the leaders of his family. In the end, Oduche died, and Aneto was taken to Umuru and hanged. The other people were released, but even now they have not found the mouth with which to tell of their suffering. The two men sat in silence for a long while afterwards. Page 178. Chapter 21. There were many men and women in Umuofia who did not feel as strongly as Okonkwo about the new dispensation. The white man had indeed brought a lunatic religion. But he'd also built a trading store, and for the first time palm oil and kernel became things of great price, and much money flowed into Umuofia. And even in the matter of religion, there was a growing feeling that there might be something in it after all, something vaguely akin to method in the overwhelming madness. This growing feeling was due to Mr. Brown, the white missionary, who was very firm in restraining his flock from provoking the wrath of the clan. One member in particular was very difficult to restrain. His name was Enoch, and his father was the priest of the snake cult. The story went around that Enoch had killed and eaten the sacred python, and that his father had cursed him. Mr. Brown preached against such excessive zeal. Everything was possible, he told his energetic flock, but everything was not expedient. And so Mr. Brown came to be respected even by the clan, because he trod softly on its faith. Page 179. He made friends with some of the great men of the clan, and on one of his frequent visits to the neighboring villages, he had been presented with a carved elephant tusk, which was a sign of dignity and rank. One of the great men in that village was called Akunna, and he had given one of his sons to be taught the white man's knowledge in Mr. Brown's school. Whenever Mr. Brown went to that village, he spent long hours with Akunna in his obi, talking through an interpreter about religion. Neither of them succeeded in converting the other, but they learned more about their different beliefs. "You say that there is one supreme God who made heaven and earth," said Akunna on one of Mr. Brown's visits. "We also believe in him and call him Chukwu. He made all the world and the other gods." "There are no other gods," said Mr. Brown. "Chukwu is the only god, and all others are false. You carve a piece of wood, like that one." He pointed at the rafters from which Akunna's carved ikenga hung, "and you call it a god, but it is still a piece of wood." "Yes," said Akunna, "it is indeed a piece of wood. The tree from which it came was made by Chukwu, as indeed all minor gods were. But he made them for his messengers, so that we could approach him through them. It is like yourself. You are the head of your church." "No," protested Mr. Brown. "The head of my church is God himself." "I know," said Akunna, "but there must be a head in this world among men. Somebody like yourself must be the head here." Page 180. "The head of my church, in that sense, is in England." "That is exactly what I'm saying. The head of your church is in your country. He has sent you here as his messenger. And you have also appointed your own messengers and servants. Or let me take another example. The district commissioner. He is sent by your king." "They have a queen," said the interpreter on his own account. Your queen sends her messenger, the district commissioner. He finds that he cannot do the work alone, and so he appoints Khotma to help him. It is the same with God, or Chukwu. He appoints the smaller gods to help him because his work is too great for one person. You should not think of him as a person, said Mr. Brown. It is because you do so that you imagine he must need helpers. And the worst thing about it is that you give all the worship to the false gods you have created. That is not so. We make sacrifices to the little gods. But when they fail, and there is no one else to turn to, we go to Chukwu. It is right to do so. We approach a great man through his servants. But when his servants fail to help us, then we go to the last source of hope. We appear to pay greater attention to the little gods, but that is not so. We worry them more because we are afraid to worry their master. Our fathers knew that Chukwu was the overlord,